This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT Knoxville. 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and I'm your host, Matt Schaefer-Powell. On May 2nd, the intersecting worlds of folk music and human rights lost one of their most respected and storied characters. Guy Carawan was a performer, promoter, and curator of some of the world's great protest songs, and understood as well as anyone how music could bring about social change and economic justice. Together, he and his wife Candy sang, performed, and documented the stories of human struggle that litter the American landscape. Today on Dialogue, we remember Guy Carawan with Pam McMichael, executive director of East Tennessee's Highlander Research and Education Center, where Guy was music director. Nancy Brennan Strange, a fellow singer and close friend of the Carawans, is also here. And Bradley Reeves joins us from the Tennessee Archive of Moving Images and Sound, the new home for many of the Carawans' recordings and films. So first of all, let me thank all of you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So let me start, Pam, with you. What kind of a person was Guy Carawan? If you were describing him to a friend, what would you say?
Well, I've known Guy, a new guy, about 20 years, about 10 years before I came to Highlander. Then after moving to Highlander, he was my friend and neighbor, as well as in the work together. And I was always impressed by Guy's incredible generosity with his time and his music and the way he could inspire people around him. He was a good friend and a good neighbor and a good family person and just, you know, cared about. I think the thing that really strikes me about Guy and Candy is always on the cutting edge. You didn't have to ask them to show up. So for racial justice in the, you know, early years and from to immigrant and refugee rights to lesbian, gay, trans people working for social justice, Guy and Candy are always there.
They were always there. Like you said, nobody had to bring that to their attention. They were already aware of.
Always on the cutting edge.
Yeah. What do you think it was about? You mentioned that people, I don't know if this is exactly the word you used, but they kind of gravitated toward him. What was it about his presence that people latched onto?
Well, I think the joy in the sharing of the music and the messages in those music and the way music was made accessible to people who musicians love to play with Guy, and also people like me who didn't consider themselves musicians love to be around that. And it's inspiring and it's uplifting and it builds relationships with people and it teaches and it connects.
Nancy, you are a musician and a singer as well, and you have performed with Guy. What, outside of that realm, what kind of a person was Guy?
He was a real curious kind of person, and he was also real encouraging to all the musicians. And he was had kind of a playful personality too, which I liked about him. Like, I know he did a lot of serious stuff, but it's always fun being around him.
He's a funny guy.
Yeah, it had a great sense of humor. Yeah. And he, like so many musicians, he encouraged us to play. He and Candy kind of mentored. I couldn't even tell you how many people, like, and that we all became friends with him too. And just a great person to be around. And he supported me when I'd, even like in the last 15 years or so, if I had a gig somewhere, he and Candy would, they'd be there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I wouldn't know they were coming and they'd come in. He always introduced me to people and he would say stuff like, "This is Nancy. She's a beautiful singer."
Mm-hmm.
And I was always like, "This is Guy Carawan saying that about me."
That's true.
Very, very generous and giving to people and fun and really great with kids. And he's a great father and great husband.
Bradley, how would you describe him to somebody who didn't know Guy?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I came along too late to know Guy Carawan. I wish I could have. I've met Guy once, and at that time, he wasn't in the greatest of health. But there was a sweetness that just mm-hmm. shone through, a real kindness, a real gentleness. And I was really, really impressed with him. Candy, I've gotten to know just a little bit better, and I've really enjoyed speaking with her. And I found them both to be a very charming couple.
And you have had the opportunity through some of the materials that that have been donated.
Oh yeah.
To see films and movie footage and those sorts of things. What kind of impression do you get about Guy that comes from those recorded materials?
Well, it's amazing to me. You know, you almost feel like you get to know Guy through all these old movies that were mm-hmm. produced back in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and you see how he's grown and developed over the years and how he changed with the times. But one thing that I've noticed throughout is Guy was always Guy. He never made commercial considerations in his music or his film. He was who he was. He was very sincere, very honest, and very genuine in all respects.
What were some of the passions that you saw that kind of moved Guy? What was I mean, it seems obvious what was he passionate about. Well, he was passionate about economic justice and racial justice and those sorts of things. But deeper than that, what do you think it was that moved him toward those causes and being that kind of person?
I think he was passionate about making a connection with people. Yeah. Like, it was real, wherever he went, he was going to make friends with people and have them singing along. And that was real important to him as a tool too in organizing, to get people to sing with him. But I think music was probably one of his greatest passions. And he played a lot of different instruments, and you know, he went to China and learned about the hammer dulcimer there, and
Soviet Union, 1957.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that he and Candy went to the Soviet Union and China at the risk of losing their passports.
Right.
Because, of course, as you remember, 1957, this was right in the middle of the Cold War. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what's amazing to me. Music seems like such a huge part. I mean, music every day of his life, music in some form or fashion. And the recordings bear that out, you know, the LPs, the reel-to-reel recordings, all the music that has come to us through various sources, including the Kerouans themselves, and a wide array of music, blues, folk, Appalachian mountain ballads, music of the British Isles, field recordings. It's just an incredible diverse array of folk music.
Pam, when we're talking about passions and the sorts of specific things that moved Guy, what did you witness?
Well, when in thinking about the music and what that he touched so many lives with his music, and it was also the music that led him to the incredible experiences of his life and that shaped his life in terms of, you know, the meeting people and coming south and meeting, you know, Pete Seeger's suggestion that he come to Highlander and become the music director after Zelfia's death. So I think the combination of his music and his caring about people and, you know, human and civil rights is embodied in that Ain't You Got a Right to the Tree of Life. It's kind of a signature song that we also know Guy by, that don't we all have a right to live that way?
You mentioned that P. Seeger was the one who suggested that he come to the Highlander Institute, and I believe 1959, is that right? Yeah, somewhere around there.
Yeah, Guy came in 59.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about how Guy came. I mean, when we see Guy and Candy, I think sometimes we assume that they're East Tennesseans, born and bred, but Guy was actually from California. How did this come to be?
Well, that's right.
How did this come to be that the Kerouans ended up in East Tennessee at the Highlander?
Well, I think connected to the music was a curiosity, and so he traveled with his music, and he came south in 56, I think, and met people at Highlander and traveled on to the Northeast and through some of the experiences that, you know, Nancy and Bradley mentioned. And so then when he came in 59, he became the music director in Zelfia's absence. But he also drove Septima Clark around. She came to work at Highlander after being fired for her activism for racial justice. And it was also that experience of driving her around. He told many stories about that experience. So those passions are embodied in those collections of experiences.
Something I've also read kind of universally about him, and you're alluding to it, the three of you are alluding to this as well, is that Guy was sort of self-effacing. He was not about, it was not about Guy. And I wonder sometimes if maybe he may have inadvertently compromised his own significance within, say, the civil rights movement, because he was so self-effacing. He wasn't standing out there saying, I did this, or I'm doing this. Is it possible that maybe he might have compromised a little bit of his own legacy because of his personality being so self-effacing?
I would say yes. I think that he was so self-effacing that he just didn't promote himself. And that wasn't his interest. It wasn't to be a star or a hero or what have you. It was all genuine. And that comes across. You know, you hear about Pete Seeger and all these other folk musicians who landed major label contracts and went on to do television and what have you. Mm-hmm. Guy did that as well, but he didn't really promote it to the point of, superstardom,
yeah,
what have you. But that's what makes him so great, I think.
I think he just really wanted to be a lot of the things that he played for. It's like he could have made a choice to try to be a more commercial musician, but he was more interested in the music that he was doing, that was using music as a tool to help people organize, because he did so much of that. Like, anytime something was going on where people needed music, like when I first knew him, he was going up to Stearns, Kentucky, because the miners were striking, and he and Candy went up there regularly for years.
Go ahead, Pam.
Where I would say with that question, Matt, is in thinking about, like, I made a couple of calls after his passing to Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee members, and I was just immediately, people went to the influence he was on their lives, the space he helped opened up for people to think about being music people and movement people, and just immediately people went to those places. And I know, you know, in my experience at Highlander, people are always, when I travel, when groups come, they wanted to work with Guy and Candy. Mm-hmm. When I travel, people ask about Guy and Candy. So people, there's a great understanding of his impact on music and on people's lives, individually and collectively.
I also read that Guy's temperament was perfect for the civil rights movement. And for, again, I want to make sure that we include some of these other causes that he's been involved in, but specifically for the civil rights movement, where he's the kind of guy who could be arrested and thrown into jail, and his temperament was such that he was kind of unflappable. Is that, Pam, is that how you saw him?
Well, yeah, I think Guy has had an easy, in the rest connected to Highlander, these are, you know, were stories that I've heard, and I think that he was arrested the night that Highlander was raided in 1959 with three other people, I think, and one of the signature verses of "We Shall Overcome," "We Are Not Afraid," came from that experience, from a young woman from the Montgomery Improvement Association, Mary Ethel Dozier. So it was, you know, Guy, it was. His experiences were often collective in terms of what you're building together.
Was he a good story? I mean, obviously he was a musician, but was he also a good storyteller? The kind of guy you could just kind of,
yes,
listen to him talk about some of these experiences?
Well, whenever he was singing too, he'd be telling stories about the songs and things that he'd been through. But he was a great storyteller. I guess I'd think of him as a storyteller with the music too, the song, right. the kind of songs he wanted to sing were all telling a story.
Sure, yeah. Now, how did Guy come to see folk music and old spirituals as a form of protest? Because my understanding is that, yes, it was there, but a lot of people hadn't necessarily connected the dots yet. And even Martin Luther King wrote, he never thought of spirituals and as movement material until he heard Guy.
Maybe some of that is like the song "We Shall Overcome" or "Ain't You Got It Right," where those kind of songs are call and response kind of songs. Mm-hmm. So you're singing something and people sing back to you. And I think he just, by being exposed to those kind of old gospel hymns that are call and response songs, it just really reached out to a certain community, you know. Like, he might have, I know I read something that he had said about "We Shall Overcome" where he played it one way and then somebody said, "Well, let us, you know, sing it." And they kind of sang like, turned it into a whole different thing. Like,
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a little time and talk about "We Shall Overcome" specifically. But first, we're going to take a real quick break here on Dialogue. Today, we're talking, we're remembering, rather, Guy Carawan, the legendary civil rights musicologist and longtime East Tennessee resident. Carawan died last month. If you have a question or a story you'd like to share, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or you can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT.
Thank you.
This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, and we're taking some time on Dialogue today to remember the late Guy Carawan, whom you hear singing in the background. We're joined by Pam McMichael from the Highlander Center, archivist and curator Bradley Reeves from the Tennessee Archive of Moving Images and Sound, and Nancy Brennan Strange, local singing legend and good friend of the Carawans. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook, or by calling us at 974-5050. Now, as I pointed out at the top of the show and as we were listening to right now, Guy's perhaps best known for introducing that song, We Shall Overcome, to the Civil Rights Movement. How did that come about? How did that song find its way onto Guy's guitar and from there into becoming this anthem for the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, Guy learned a version. The song went through, was an old spiritual song that became a labor song and then a movement song, and it went through different adaptations and arrangements and evolving. And he learned it first from Zelfia Horton, who was the music director preceding him at the Highlander Center. And then he put his cut on it, and other people did as the song continued to be. So, you know, the story I'm told is that he stood up at the closing conference of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Raleigh, North Carolina in 1960 and started strumming it. And people stood up and did the crossover, you know, of their arms. And in that way, the signature movement, you know, the signature song of the Civil Rights Movement was born.
Do you think Guy knew that that particular song might have that kind of effect? Or do you think it was just one in his arsenal that just happened to catch on?
I think he just started singing it and was, and all these people got up and started, like Pam said, holding hands, you know, like singing it together with him. And he just realized how powerful
it was.
So
he might have been as surprised, really, as anybody, that that particular song, not that he would have been surprised because there was something heartfelt about him singing that song, but he might have been surprised that it took on the kind of life that
it did. Just had so much power.
Yeah.
And the way it's gone around the world into so many movements and come back, you know, to the U.S. through many countries and movements is quite a testament to the power of the song.
You know, when I think about the song, I'm wondering what it is that resonates about that particular song with people, not only involved in the movement. And I was thinking about it from a personal standpoint, and I mean this with all respect, it's a bit of an earworm. I mean, it's a song that gets
it's
into
catchy.
Your head, and it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Well, I like the bluesy feel to it. That's one of my favorite parts of the song, and it's just a great song altogether, the chord structure, all of it, and you can't hear it enough. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of that era.
And for people to be singing it, too, it's got, like you just heard on the recording, there's so much harmony, like everybody's, and it's a song you can catch onto really quickly. And
it's easy to play on guitar.
Yeah.
I think four chords
four
or something
chords,
like that.
Yeah.
And it was connected to a movement full of vision and courage and risk. So I think, like, as the Civil Rights Movement was active and made more public through newsreels and the singing of the song, it was also a part of the way why it moved around the world as well, the song in and of itself, and also that it was connected to a movement so tied with such courage and vision and risk.
Did Guy get any kind of personal charge out of seeing it? You talked about it coming back around through all these different movements throughout the world, some that he may never have touched personally, but here it was, they might have been singing this song.
I never heard him talk about,
I'm
so great in that song. I think he was just really happy that people were using it, but I think he just realized, too, the power. That's an empowering song, and you know, all these kind of Northern Ireland used it in their civil rights movement. And I was reading the Velvet Revolution in Prague. I mean, so many other places and so many other causes where people just sing it. But, I mean, it totally goes back to him.
But, you know, there became this, I don't know if I should call it an urban legend because it's not really that, but it's this this piece of information that Guy wrote the song. Some people believe that Guy wrote the song, but he never, ever tried to make that claim, and he probably tried to clarify that, no, I didn't write this song.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, well, his name, I believe, is on there with Pete Seeger, Frank Hamilton.
Frank Hamilton and Sylvia Horton.
The royalties, I believe, go to the Highlander and fund several, well, just various grant projects.
Yeah. Is that true? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. There's a fund set up and an advisory committee outside of our board and staff that the funds go back to the communities, Southern African American communities, working at that nexus of art and social change as a way for the commercial royalties to give back to the communities that that song came from.
Well, hey, our friend Lou Gross is on the phone, and Lou, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Pam. Hi, Brad.
Hi.
Hi, Lou.
Hi.
Everybody knows
Hi.
Lou.
Hello.
Yeah. So, Lou, you have a story about Guy that you'd like to share.
I do. I have. I'll do two quick ones. I've, of course, known Guy for a very long time, and the first time I remember talking to him was at the University of Tennessee Aquatic Center, where he and Candy were doing a performance to a very small crowd. And
In the pool area?
It was in the just outside the pool area.
Okay.
Outside, and we were talking, and we were talking about mathematics because Guy's degree, his undergraduate degree, was in mathematics from Occidental College. And over the years, I've told lots of people that mathematically trained person who has had more influence around the world than anyone else was Guy Carroll.
Oh, wow. And that's a really interesting thought. Not something I would have automatically come to that conclusion.
No. But in terms of mathematics, of course, he would not have claimed he was a mathematician, but he certainly had formal training. And I think that did instill a different, I'll call it a logical way of thinking. And one other quick story, because it involves WOT, is that in, I believe it was 1987, I was still doing the Live at Laurel radio show, and I was in the studio, and Guy and Candy came in, and I said, oh, great, what are you here for? And they said, well, we've been asked to do this song, and it's kind of funny, given all the other things that we do, that this is what's become of interest now. And it was a song about Reagan. The details of which I don't recall, except that it had a chorus that was, Ronnie was caught between a rock and a hard place. And it was not a very positive song about Ronald Reagan. And I don't know if Nancy remembers that song or not.
I don't remember that one.
Does that one sound, Bradley, does that sound familiar to you?
No, it doesn't.
No, interesting one.
I'd like to know.
I was going to say it was lost to time, but it wasn't, because, Lou, you still carry that memory.
Yeah. So Guy was wonderful, and Candy is still wonderful, and they're just great folks.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Lou. Thanks for the call. And you can call us at 974-5050, 974-5050. If you have a memory of Guy Carawan, or if you'd like to ask some questions of the folks who have come here today to remember him, Pam McMichael is the executive director at the Highlander Center. Bradley Reeves is from the Tennessee Archive of Moving Images and Sound. And Nancy Brennan Strange is a singer of great repute here in East Tennessee and a good friend of the Carawan. So give us a call at 974-5050, 974-5050. What kind of a musician? We're talking about him as a song leader, but what kind of a musician was he in terms of his technical abilities with a guitar or hammered dulcimer?
He's a great musician. Yeah. He played hammered dulcimer, guitar, penny whistle. He really liked Irish tunes and really got into playing
banjo.
Banjo, yes. Yeah. Oh. In fact, he gave me a banjo and Linda Paris Bailey from Carpetbag Theater because he had gone on a tour in Germany. Mm-hmm. He toured Germany and Ireland. Anyway, he just...
And you still have that him. You still have that banjo.
I play that banjo all the time, yeah. It's a Framus banjo that was made in Germany, and he had two of them that he just shared with us. And I think that was back in 1977 when he gave it to me. But he was a great musician. He did a lot of different kind of tunings with the guitar. For a lot of the music he did, but just...
Which is, for we amateurs, that's sort of the fork in the road. When, as soon as people start messing with the tuning, people like me just check right out, like, okay, nah, I've reached my wall. Well, that's interesting, though. And did he enjoy just sitting around and playing it by himself?
Absolutely,
and learning? And
I think so. I think he's a total musician. Like, if you saw him at his house, he probably was... playing the guitar or playing something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've talked, we were talking about We Shall Overcome and his role in the civil rights movement. But I want to talk for just a moment. I'm not sure if Greg can hear us right now. But I want to talk a little bit about his pre-movement career in the 50s and that sort of thing. Bradley, what kind of a musician was he at that point? And let me clarify something, too. It's not as if he just stumbled upon the civil rights movement and became. He was passionate about some of these causes even then. But
oh, sure.
His music is a little bit more mainstream in terms of being able to, it's not as politically motivated.
Well, he always loved that music. And that was, even in the 50s, he was cutting these amazing records for the Folkways label. Mm-hmm. And, not many people know that. They're great albums. They're classic if you can find them. A great musician even then in the 1950s with a natural love for the form. There was a recent article in Oxford Mercury written by my coworker Eric Dawson, who mentioned a trip down south in 1953 with it was Guy – and, who was
Frank Hamilton.
Was it Frank Hamilton?
And Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, they're amazing stories, just traveling through the South, experiencing music and visiting with different musicians, including A.P. Carter in Mesa Springs. They just sat around and picked a little bit. Visited the Grand Old Opry and met with String Bean and some of the other folks. So it was quite a time for him. And he was interested even then. He just kind of parlayed that into a musical career of his own. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to play a little piece. I believe this is called Old Blue. Old Blue.
It was first recorded back in the 1920s.
Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
I had a dog and his name was Blue. I had a dog and his name was Blue. Yes, I had a dog and his name was Blue. I bet you $5 he's a good one too. Yeah, oh Blue, you good dog you. Well, I shouldered my axe and I tooted my horn. Gonna catch me a possum in the new ground corn. Yeah, oh Blue, you can come too.
So that's Old Blue by Guy Carawan. And you said this is a...
What a voice.
What a voice. You get more of a sense of his voice and also a little bit of his guitar. You can hear a little bit more of his skills with a guitar in that particular song. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that album, Bradley.
Oh, gosh. This may be his first, second album released back in 1958. Songs with Guy Carawan. It's got a great picture of him on the cover. Looking like the troubadour that he was.
Mm-hmm.
And the album itself is wonderful. It's just him and his guitar all the way through it, doing these old folk songs. Old Blue, we know, was recorded in the 1920s, and it was an older song even then by the time Guy recorded it, 30 years later. They're fabulous records, and part of a wonderful discography that ranges all the way up to the 2000s. I mean, that's 50 years of wonderful recorded music.
We have a handful of people standing by waiting to contribute to today's program. So let me go to Mike. Mike, you're on Dialogue. Welcome.
Hey.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Mike. I was told I was the third in line. But
Surprise.
Surprise.
Lied to again. Hey, I've known Guy and Candy for a long time, and I think one of the things that you've been all the things you've been talking about are kind of explained by Guy's just love of learning. When the first stories I heard about him was traveling in the islands of the Carolinas, collecting these stories, and I think when you talk to Guy about those things, you would get these incredible details, and he was clearly there to learn about the people. And when he heard their songs, he's doing civil rights work, and he hears the songs and thinks, that's what this is about. And that's how I think those things get integrated. I just always liked being around Guy. He was just an incredible guy. And we'll really miss him. And I just would pass along my best wishes to Candy and the family.
Mike, thanks so much for calling us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Mike, let's go to Charles, who's also calling from Knoxville. Charles, you're on Dialogue. Welcome.
Yes, I just merely have a little anecdote about Guy. It happened, maybe 20-something years ago. It was at the Laurel Theater. I don't even remember the event, but things had gotten pretty informal. And Guy was there with his guitar, and there was a little circle of youngsters around him, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old. And Guy was playing directly to them. And I remember he was playing the old Woody Guthrie song, How'd You Do? How'd You Do? And it's got a little line in it there about, you stick out your little hand, how'd you do? And that's just a memory that stayed with me of these, you know, Guy playing directly to these little kids and their fascination on their face, you know. And Guy, of course, you know, wasn't anything conventionally in it for him, you know, he wasn't getting paid for it, but just that little scene there has just stuck with me for years, and I just thought I'd pass that along to you.
Well, thanks so much, Charles. And Nancy, you mentioned that that he loved to sing to kids.
He did. He did a lot of kids' concerts.
Yeah.
I remember a song he did, My Rhinoceros. He has such a beautiful smile.
Bravo.
Bravo. Yeah. Let's take another call. Let's go to Keith, who's calling as well from Knoxville. Keith, you're on the air on Dialogue. Are you there, Keith? I may have inadvertently hung up on Keith. Uh-oh. I hope not.
Oops.
How about Dan? Dan, you're on the air.
I'm here. Thank you. Hi, Nancy. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
I wanted to share a story of playing music with Guy and Candy in the 70s. I started doing some gigs with Guy in about 1976 or 7, and I really didn't know Guy's history with We Shall Overcome at the time. I knew he had been involved in the civil rights movement. But we played around some places, and we played at a Unitarian church in another city, and Guy started singing We Shall Overcome. And I thought, man, is this corny or what, you know? and then I read his history, you know, and his connection to that, and I was just kind of flabbergasted by that. And you know, it was an education to me, you know, how much greatness there was that I was getting to share some music with in person.
Dan, thanks so much for the call this afternoon.
One other thing, y'all were talking about children's music just now, and even when Guy couldn't remember most people's names, he still loved children. I saw him with his grandchild just enjoying being next to that child, and it was really something to see. And he was a wonderful man, and my love goes out to Candy. Thanks. That's all I got.
Dan, thanks so much for calling this afternoon.
You.
I really appreciate it. You know, Dan made some references to how Guy and Candy were as performers, and you've performed with them, Nancy. What was his onstage persona like? Was it the same as his offstage persona, or
it kind of was? I mean, he just totally calm on stage and inviting to people, and whenever you went to a concert of Guy and Candy, everybody was singing along, and they'd had all different kind of songs, like some in Spanish and stuff. But they were always very warm on stage, and Guy, he seemed like the same person on stage as off to me, like. Yeah. I never sensed like this big ego or anything when he was just so great.
It appears like he had just incredible charisma and presence on stage, judging from the film and video that we've digitized, and just very, he just draws you in. You can't help but loving what he's doing.
Did you see that as well, Pam?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And you've had the opportunity to see him perform many times.
See him perform in front of larger crowds and in a circle of rocking chairs at Highlander, and just, you know, great inspiration and invitation to the music.
Right.
You want to be part of it.
We're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Today we're remembering Guy Carawan, the legendary civil rights musicologist. and longtime East Tennessee resident. Kerouan died last month. If you have a question or a story you'd like to share, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or call us at 974-5050. It's 974-5050, and this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, and we're taking some time on Dialogue today to remember the late Guy Kerouan. We're joined by Pam McMichael from the Highlander Center, curator Bradley Reeves from the Tennessee Archive of Moving Images and Sound in Knoxville, and Nancy Brennan Strange, local singing legend and good friend of the Kerouans. And whenever I say legend, she blushes.
She's a legend.
She says, aw, shucks. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook, or by calling us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And Nancy, just before the, or during the break, rather, we were talking about how you remember a particular trip.
This is probably how I kind of got to know Guy and Candy pretty well, is they were going to the Smithsonian in 1976, had a big bicentennial festival. Mm-hmm. And so they were headed up to Washington for that, and I knew they were going and asked them if I could go too. Mm-hmm. And I actually didn't know them that well yet, but they were really nice and let me go with them. And so Guy had this station wagon. We all got in it, and we stopped somewhere near Bristol, and we picked up some other musicians. One was Earl Gilmore. He was from Virginia, and he's a African-American blues piano player. Mm-hmm. And then a couple, Jim and Alberta Stanley, and they were from Appalachia, Virginia. But, I mean, that whole trip, I just saw how much Guy, was reaching out to people like that and getting them out to perform. And I saw that so many times with him. Go ahead.
Yeah, I understand that he's also, Guy and Candy are part of the Civil Rights exhibit at the Smithsonian.
They should be.
Deservedly so.
We actually have a tweet from Kelly Jolly, who is telling us that.
Yeah. Hello,
Listen,
Kelly.
We want to make sure Keith gets an opportunity to talk today. Keith, you are on Dialogue. Sorry about hanging up on you last time. And I'm afraid
he's gone again.
Keith is gone again. This is not Keith's day. But let's give Larry a shot. Larry, you are calling from Knoxville, and you are live on Dialogue.
Hello?
Yes, there you go. And it was me.
Oh,
it was.
Matt.
I was, yes. Oh,
naughty.
Boy, poor Keith. Yeah. Larry, go ahead. You are live on the show. And, of course, we're talking about Guy Kerouan today. And what did you want to talk about?
Well, I met a guy, I guess, about 30 years ago when I started, after I'd moved to the region to teach at Carson Newman University, and started going out to Highlander and taking students out there. And he and Candy oftentimes met with student groups that I would take, and he was always very gracious and helpful in terms of putting them at ease and involving them in song. He would generally, once I got to know him a little better, he would make fun in a good way of academics, us academics in the ivory tower, with a parody of a Frank Sinatra song that he would sing that kind of poke fun at the pompous side, I guess, of higher ed.
Well, he had license to do that because he himself was an educated man. He had a master's degree.
Yeah, he had a graduate degree.
So he could do
and
that.
was definitely a scholar musician. I worked with the Appalachian Center at Carson Newman for a number of years, and we awarded he and Candy the educational award to Appalachia, which is one of the highest awards that Carson Newman gives. For their work as educators through music. And I think that's one of the take-home lessons that I've I've learned from Guy and Candy is that music is much more than light entertainment, that it's deadly serious when it comes to educating hard truths and important truths and speaking truth to power. And he and Candy are irreplaceable. And I think what Guy would say to us is carry on. Keep your eyes on the prize and keep singing.
Very well put. Larry, thanks so much for the call this afternoon.
You bet.
And we're going to go to another old friend of ours. Bill Landry is on the line. Bill, welcome to Dialogue.
Hey, good morning. Glad to be here.
Great to hear you.
Hey, Bill.
Well, say hello to everybody. They've all contributed to the heartland and the region, and what a great group you're with. I just wanted to say hello to Candy and Evan and my deepest sympathies with a great man. And Guy was just so good to us, available, and it's just wonderful to hear hear the old blue song. I think that was the first time I ever heard that song when we were in his living room. He played it on a hammer dulcimer. And Danny's right.
Yeah.
And just one of the great people ever came out of this region, and I'm proud to got to know him a little bit. What a gentle, generous man. And he's just nothing but great memories for us, and we're lucky to get to spend so much time with him, and just the reservoir of amazing music and educational memories. He sent me down to Kiowa. My son was in college down there, and Guy told me about all that wonderful work collecting songs in some of those churches down there, and we got to visit some of them, our family and I, because of Guy. So, well, just my best, and if ever I can do something for Candy or anybody, just let me know.
Bill, thanks so much. Thanks so much for calling,
okay.
And it was
bye-bye.
Great to hear from you today. Keith, we are going to come hell or high water. We're going to get you on the air today. Are you there?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Hi, Keith.
All right. Sorry about the struggles there, Keith, but you are on the air now.
A memory I had of Guy and Candy was from about 30 some odd years ago, when there was an effort being made to try and organize homeless individuals to represent themselves in the policies that were being set up in the different shelters. And at that time, the Appalachian Community Fund gave a small grant to Volunteer Ministry Center. And Bill Murrah and Kenny Woodhull worked with the homeless folks to do that. The people themselves elected a president, a guy named Pops Sanders, who got some training at Highlanders in the process. And years later, when Pops passed away, and by that time he'd actually found housing, lived here, but didn't have family around or anyone around. There was a memorial service held at Volunteer Ministry Center for Pops, and Guy and Candy came down, excuse me.
How about that?
And played for that. And it meant a lot to Pops' daughter, from whom he'd been estranged for several years. We made a tape of it and sent to her, and the fact that Guy and Candy took the time to come down and personally knew him and respected him meant a great deal to the family that was there. Very generous people.
Well, Keith, I'm so glad that we were able to finally get you on the air so you could share that great story. Thanks so much for calling today.
Sure.
We have time for one more call, I think, now. Linda is calling from Strawberry Plains. Linda, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Yes, I am. I work at Highlander sort of part-time with the children's programs, and we actually do a children's camp each summer, a week-long residential camp, and I just wanted to share how much the children always enjoyed Guy coming up and playing music and doing interactive music with the kids. It was just, he was like a magnet. They just were drawn to him, and was always such a very magnetic but yet humble and mellow type person. And I think that made the kids just feel so comfortable. And I also, I got to know him through Highlander even before that, before I became involved with the children's camp. And our children's camp, actually, a group of us started it, I think it's 31 years ago now. But I met him at some programs at Highlander, and he was always just willing to be very spontaneous with his music. And it was always, he was the person that just made everybody feel so comfortable. You know, people came from various places, and many of us didn't know each other, but yet it was Guy that often just brought us all together through his music and made us all just really gel together and feel very comfortable.
Linda, thank you so much for sharing your impressions of Guy and for joining us today. And we should point out, too, that we have heard that Candy is listening. So we certainly give our best wishes to Candy in this difficult time. And I also wanted to point out that we got a tweet from Kelly Jolly, our own Kelly Jolly, mm-hmm. and I didn't see the entire tweet, and I really want to pass this on because it's really, it says something. She says, Guy and Candy Carawan are part of the civil rights exhibit at the Smithsonian. When I saw it, it moved me to tears. So thank you for that, Kelly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about the music, and we only have a few more minutes left in the show, but I want to make sure that we also understand that Guy and Candy were documentarians mm-hmm. as well. They produced some recordings. They created some films about some of the things that they saw. And Bradley, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, we've been honored to work on the Carawan film collection, which Candy had retrieved from the closet over at their home. And it's just the most amazing collection of bluegrass festivals from the early 60s and Foxfire 1974 and an amazing film that was done at the John's Island, South Carolina, which documented some of the people in singing the gospel, singing the stories, the chants, children's stories. I mean, it's just an amazing, amazing example of Guy's work as a musicologist. And it's the same with the recordings. There's also recordings that he made at John's Island back in the 1960s. So not only was he a recording artist, he definitely was out there in the field capturing a lot of this music and some of it, which was rapidly vanishing mm-hmm. even then.
And they have three books that Guy and Candy wrote together that are amazing, and they've got all these songs in them and stories and photographs. And one's the Civil Rights Movement, one's St. John's Island, and one's Voices from the Mountains, and they're all great books. Like,
how can we get our hands on some of this material, these films, and see some of these films and read some of these books?
I know some of the books are at Highlander.
Yeah, Highlander yeah. Center could be a resource for some of the books and the films, Brad.
Anyone that would like to make an appointment could come down to the East Tennessee History Center where the archive is located and take a look. And occasionally we screen them for the public.
You did recently, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Nancy and I worked on a great project. It's called Jubilee, a tribute to Guy and Candy Carawan. And it was a wonderful night, just full of love and music and kind of the spirit of cooperation that Guy and Candy are all about.
We've also talked a lot about Guy's and Candy's involvement in the civil rights movement. But as I mentioned earlier in the show, they were involved in a lot more than just the American civil rights movement. Pam, can you tell us a few of the other causes that they were very intrinsically involved in?
Well, you know, and some of the stories that we've heard this hour also, you know, it was to hear that about the work with the homeless and the, mm-hmm. and, you know, some of the, mm-hmm. so the immigrant and refugee rights, like I mentioned earlier, just you never had to ask Guy and Candy to show up or to, they were always on the cutting edge. So what's happening, how injustice or oppression or discrimination is manifesting itself, they are there. So they've been an ally and a friend to lesbian, gay, trans people organizing for equality and liberation. They've been an ally in solidarity with immigrants and refugee people fighting for immigrant and refugee rights. So the people of Appalachia, people in community. So whatever you're facing, they've been a strong friend and ally.
Do you think, and we've only got two more minutes left in the show, but do you think that looking back that there's anything else that Guy would have wanted to have accomplished in his life? Or do you think that if he had had the opportunity to plot it out that it would have pretty much looked the way it did? I mean, I realize this is speculation, by the way, too. Sure.
Well, I mean, when I look as somebody looking at, I feel like that I have so much respect and love and appreciation for a life well lived. Mm-hmm. And I think that Guy could celebrate that. And I guess one last thing, you know, I just really, to know Guy is to know how much he loved Candy Carawan. And that was always, you know, so when we talk about what kind of person Guy was, and I want to get that part in as well.
Absolutely.
He seemed like a happy person to me. I mean, I think he was happy with his life, and he had a great Candy and Evan and Heather and just now, and Naomi now. But he just seemed like he was happy with his life to me. Like,
And Bradley, from what you've seen from the films and the stories and everything, how would you respond to that?
I don't know. He seems like an honest, genuine, and loving individual, greatly talented, and he leaves behind a wonderful legacy. And we hope, personally, at TAMIS, that we can help keep that legacy going through the preserved recordings and motion picture films and videotapes for future generations.
Well, this has been a very fun hour. Yeah. It's been a very interesting hour, and it's great to hear from so many folks who reached out to us today and wanted to share their stories of Guy Carawan. We are running out of time here on Dialogue, and so first of all, I want to thank our guests. Pam McMichael is Executive Director Highlander Center, and Nancy Brennan Strange. Singing legend?
Oh. Admit it.
Well, I already did, yeah. All so right. There you go. Nancy Brennan Strange and Bradley Reeves from the Tennessee
Tennessee Archive of Moving Image and Sound.
I got it every single time before.
Oh, that's all right.
We also want to say thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate you.
Thank you. Thanks also to Greg Hill, who ran the board and handled the phones today. Thanks to Brittany Crocker for watching our social media. And thank you for listening and calling and sharing your stories and sending your questions. If you missed the show or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our webpage in the next hour or so. You can find it at WUOT.org. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM, WUOT Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org, a listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.